Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Supreme Court demonstrations and the upcoming Sussman trial. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How's it going?
It's going. I'm a little frenzied at the moment. I'm on a roadie. I'm headed to Philadelphia tonight to see our pal Victoria Coates.
Awesome.
And do an NRI event. Looking forward to seeing a lot of NR folks there.
Is that the Union League Club in Philadelphia?
It was supposed to be, but I think there's some issue with the mask mandates. I can't keep track anymore. They like put them back on or took them back off. But I think in order to hold a stable date, we may be having it someplace like right at the Meridian something club or something, right outside Philadelphia proper, like 5 miles outside the city.
The Union League Club in Philadelphia is quite the institution. And I myself saw Victoria Coates also at an NRI event this past Monday, a little mini foreign policy conference at the National Press Club, where they still make you show proof of vaccination. I was like, are we really still going through this charade? But I guess we are.
Well, that must have been, was that with Elliot Abrams too?
So Victoria was on a panel with Elliot, moderated by our colleague Jay Nordlinger, and Tom Cotton gave the keynote. And
fabulous.
Just sort of emphasizing in this moment with what's going on in Ukraine, and it just shows the that we need to be ever vigilant, strong defense, forward-leaning, but prudent national security policy. But anyway, we're not here to discuss that this afternoon. We're recording a little early on a Thursday afternoon rather than our custom Friday. So we've had these protests. Latest, I guess, was this morning at Amy Comey Barrett's house. Women in the Handmaid's Tale costumes, not many of them. Dan McLaughlin tweeted, well, I think Amy Comey Barrett's family outnumbers these demonstrators. But we've had them at Alito's house, at Kavanaugh's house, and at Roberts' house beginning over the weekend. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's terrible that we're normalizing this. And I'm when I say we, I mean the country. And I specifically mean the president and the administration. This is, it's just astonishing to me that people would think that this is okay. I understand that there is another side that has a lot of passion, as Jen Psaki puts it, regarding the abortion issue. It's been a hot button for a half a century. That's exactly why it should have been left to the political process. I think it's terrible. We've gotten 50 years. I mean, just take a minute how bad we're at. It's been a commonplace for about, I don't know, 20 years more now that people think it makes total sense to go protest outside the Supreme Court and to protest outside trials when trials are governed by the rule of your political liars. Judges are supposed to apply the law whether they like or not, as it is, not their preferences. Yet we've conducted ourselves in this country for a quarter of a century, at least, under the assumption that it really makes a difference to have these demonstrations in order to try to push the judges in one direction or another. And I guess what we're now seeing is the capper on top of all of that, because these demonstrations are now not just the ones outside the Supreme Court, which, by the way, now has to have fencing around it, just like Congress had to have fencing around it after January 6th because they're worried about the threat to the court itself as a facility and to the justices as well. So we not only have that ridiculous situation, but we now have people think it's okay to go to the homes of the jurists and demonstrate. And to the extent there was any confusion on their part about that, the White House is telling them it's fine as long as they're peaceful, which is ridiculous. So I just think it's a terrible measure of where we are norm-wise in the country. And it's a complete perversion of what the judicial system is and what the judicial function is.
So discuss the legal status of these protests. Seem a pretty black and white violation of a federal statute. Is that the case? One, and two, who would be in charge of enforcing this law?
Well, it is a black and white violation of at least one federal statute, which is basically a misdemeanor statute. And it would not only be the job of the Justice Department to enforce the statute with the help of the FBI, as usual. The FBI is usually the lead federal agency with respect to most crimes in the federal penal code. But the essential conduct, Rich, that is criminalized in this particular provision, which is section 1507 in the penal code, is what's known as parading or picketing.
Yeah, which is a lot about parading since January 6th.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because what I was about to say is, you know, not only is it obvious that the Justice Department would have the authority and the responsibility to bring these kinds of cases, they have brought hundreds of parading cases in connection with January 6th. Now, as happens, I feel like this happens, Rich, maybe we have to have maybe we should come with a disclaimer every week that saves us some time by, you know, where we always have to pause and say, look, January 6th was a terrible thing. We've condemned it. It was awful. It was an abomination. All right. So I'm saying it again. So I'm not misunderstood here. I am not saying that the only people who were involved in January 6th were paraders. There were 140 police officers who were injured, some of them terribly injured, some of them really significantly seriously injured. There was, I've seen estimates in the millions of dollars. I find that a little bit hard to believe, but not that hard to believe the way with Biden's inflation, maybe it'll be trillions of dollars by next week. But I've seen a lot of estimates of damage done to the building, although it was nothing like the kind of damage that you get in a terrorist attack and in some of the left-wing protesting that we had over the summer of, was it 2020, after George Floyd was killed. But I don't mean to understate January 6th, a very serious thing. There are hundreds of people who've been charged with serious crimes, and I hope every single one of them is convicted and gets a sentence commensurate with what he did. But at the same time, there are hundreds of people who have been charged with misdemeanor parading. We talked a couple of weeks ago about one of them who had been acquitted because it turned out that he had a viable defense. The police had waved him into the Capitol to parade around. And the Justice Department, I think, Rich, it's worth going back to that case to think about what the Justice Department's position was. Even though there was film evidence that supported the defense that this guy had been waved into the Capitol with a bunch of other peaceful protesters by Capitol Police, the Justice Department not only prosecuted him anyway, they went out and found him in New Mexico to haul him back 2,000 miles to have a trial, a misdemeanor trial in federal court. And when the proof came in that the police had waved him in, the Justice Department's position was he should be prosecuted and convicted anyway, because no matter what the police did, under the circumstances, it had to have been clear to him that he was in a place where he wasn't supposed to be, doing something he wasn't allowed to do. So that's what their position has been about parading. Nobody has suggested in connection with the January 6th cases that there's any constitutional free expression problem with those prosecutions at all. And I would point out to people that if you were going to make a case for putting external political pressure on a Department of Government, it would make sense that you would have external political pressure on Congress. They're a political body. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about now in connection with the Supreme Court is a judicial institution that in our system is intentionally insulated from politics because our presumption is they're not supposed to decide the case based on political passions. They're supposed to decide the case based on what the law says. And if they decide the case in a way that is consistent with what the law says, and on that score, you know, the Supreme Court is final. That as they always say, you know, they're not final because they're right. They're right because they're final, right? But if they get it wrong, then generally speaking, there's corrective measures that Congress can make. They're hemmed in a little bit if it's a constitutional decision. But like, for example, as we've said again and again and again and again, if the Supreme Court strikes Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that will not end abortion in America. It won't even change the way America operates the next day. What it will mean is the issue of abortion is going to be consigned to the political process, which is legislative process, which is what it should have been all along. And what Americans will probably learn when that happens, and I certainly hope it does happen, is that the regulation that'll be done at the state level, and even if there's federal legislation, I hope there's not, but if there is, I think what Americans will find is that what they get from the legislatures is a lot more consistent with what they believe the law should be than what Roe versus Wade says, because mm-hmm. they're not going to get abortion up till the moment of birth, which no one in his right mind but a fringe want.
Right.
It's obvious that the Justice Department can prosecute parading cases. They've done it hundreds of times. They're doing it as we speak. And the fact that they won't do it in connection with people who are demonstrating at the Supreme Court is a disgrace.
And so would it be the FBI, or who would go in and actually make the arrest, or do local authorities make the arrest and, you know, is prosecuted federally, or how does that work?
This is an FBI case. This is a federal case. Federal violation, the first agency, unless it's a drug case, you know, like Rich, sometimes if it's a gun offense, it's ATF. Or if it's a drug offense, the lead agency can be DEA. But with respect to all federal crimes, the FBI has jurisdiction to investigate all of them. And statutorily, for the most part, they're the lead federal agency. So presumptively, it's an FBI case. And usually you don't have to nudge them in connection with protecting the judiciary. The U.S. Marshals also have a role in protecting the judiciary, but they don't have the resources the FBI does to do criminal investigation. But this is, look, it's clearly a federal case. It would be federal authorities to come out and make it. And I just want to address, Rich, because it's important that we hit this. Why would President Biden and the White House are saying is so bad about this? What they have come out and said is that there is a strong history in this country of peaceful protest. And as long as you keep it peaceful, they're not going to take any action. And what I would say in response to that is it's a complete red herring, because if a crime does not have violence as an element, a necessary element of the crime, the fact that it's committed without violence is irrelevant. It's still a crime. So parading is a nonviolent act of political pressure. That's what it is. So for her to come out and say, for Jen Psaki to come out and say, well, as long as they're doing it peacefully, it's not a problem, is ridiculous, because there's nothing in the parading statute that requires the use of force in order for it to be a crime. So he's not enforcing the law that exists on the books. And to the extent he's saying that as long as they're acting peacefully, they're not doing anything wrong. That's just, he knows that's completely wrong. That's the reason they're prosecuting these January 6 people who didn't commit any violence. So they know that's just complete nonsense. And I think if this was in the context, Rich, of, say, a trial witness or a trial juror, like what if we had a case that was very, very controversial where a witness was coming in the next day to give testimony that was unpopular with a large segment of the population, but he was going to testify in this controversial trial the next day. If they organized a demonstration or protest outside the guy's house where everybody did nothing but fold their arms and stare, everybody would know that that's obstruction of justice, because the only purpose of it would be to have him testify in a way that the mob wanted, rather than to comply with his oath as a witness to testify according to what the truth is.
Right.
I point that out because witnesses and jurors are protected under the very same statute that judges are, the same statute that we're talking about. And the reason that no violence is required is because the government is responsible for the administration of justice, which is not supposed to be affected or influenced by threats, whether they're, you know, forcible threats or implied threats or whatever. There's always been a First Amendment doctrine known as time, place, and manner that allows the government, depending on what its interest is, to limit and restrict the amount of expression and the time and place of expression. And what the legal test is basically how important is the government interest at stake? And the more important the government interest is, the more the government is allowed to do to restrict expression. And there is no higher interest that the government has domestically than the administration of justice. If you don't have the administration of justice, you don't have the rule of law, and you don't have a society. So everybody knows this. I feel like, you know, I want to shoot myself that we even have to say these things, but that's where we are.
So despite your pessimism, which still might be proved out, unfortunately, but the latest reporting is that this five vote majority for overturning Roe is holding. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm gonna issue the same caution that I counseled everyone to have last week about what we know and what we don't know. Again, I don't think we know anything other than just Chief Justice Roberts has confirmed that opinion is an authentic Alito draft opinion. So we know that. Everything else is just reporting. And even though we are dealing with, like, I know Josh Gerstein, I've known him for a million years. I think he's a good guy. He's a good reporter. He's a careful reporter. I trust that he would not report something unless he really did have a source. But nevertheless, you know, I was a pretty good, trustworthy prosecutor too. I didn't get to prove anything in court unless I could put a witness or somebody's name on it. So I'm always very suspicious of this reporting that says it's from sources who aren't identified, under circumstances where it's a little bit difficult to parse who's speaking on the basis of knowledge, like you and I have, Rich. Like, we're informed observers who are reading all the tea leaves and calculating what must be going on, versus people who are actually inside and have knowledge. So that's my caution. However, I am persuaded by Dan McLaughlin's analysis of this, which he had a piece on the site. I don't remember if it was from last night or this morning that I saw it, Rich. As you said, we're speaking on Thursday. But Dan points out that if you follow the logic of the Politico reporting on this, number one, there is reason to believe that they have sources. After all, they did get this draft opinion and it is authentic, right? So there's reason to believe they have sources. And what Dan points out, and I think he's right about this, is if the Politico reporting is to be believed, then that kind of cuts against the theories that this may be accidentally leaked out, or it, you know, that like somebody who is not directly involved in the court, but somehow had access, like somebody who perhaps lives with a one of the judge's clerks, who might have seen an extra copy laying around the apartment and distributed it. It cuts against the theory that that's where this leak came from. And it cuts against the theory that the winning side would have any reason to leak it. Because if it were true that the majority had held, why would you want to screw that up if you were a conservative clerk, right? Mm-hmm. I think for all the reasons we said last week, it doesn't fit the conservative profile to do this in the first place in the way that it fits the conservative profile. But it's not common sense. Wanted to win and you were on the winning side, you wouldn't do anything under any circumstances to mess that up. Whereas it would be time for desperate measures if you were on the losing side with respect to something like this. So I'm inclined to believe that they do have sources within the court who are credibly saying that the majority is still holding. And I personally feel, even with all the caveats we had about particularly Justice Kavanaugh, but the other justices as well, when we discussed this last week, I personally believe that it would be a catastrophe for the court at this point if it looks like they changed the decision because of the political pressure.
Yeah.
So I'm going to change where I was at last week, Rich, since this is what you were asking me. I'm now 60-40.
Wow.
That it gets overturned.
So last week you were 50-50, right?
I was. Right. Yeah. And I told you, right, ask me again this week, you have.
The needle has moved. So let's move ahead and look forward to what's going to happen next week. Monday, we have this Sussman trial beginning, big case for John Durham. And the case itself is fairly minor, you know, not minor for anyone involved, but it's a lying to the FBI case. But for Durham, it's much bigger. It's about this scheme that you've been writing about, to this basically fraudulent scheme on the part of the Clinton campaign to create the misimpression that Trump was in cahoots with Russia, which obviously got the whole Russia hoax unspooling. So what's important to know here, and how has the pretrial jousting gone?
Well, the pretrial jousting has gone not the way Durham would have wanted, but I think at the same time, Rich, that it's gone about the way that you would normally expect, which is the government never wins everything on these things. And I point that out because, you know, I've raised concerns about Judge Cooper, who, you know, is an Obama appointee who has ties to Clinton world. I think the judge is playing it straight so far. The places where he's cut Durham and precluded him from proving things are places where any judge would be hesitant about what the government wants to do. Because mm-hmm. as we've discussed, what Durham is trying to do is prove a big scheme in order to establish a narrow crime. And that's problematic. So a judge is going to look to cut him back. And the place where he seems to have drawn the line is where Sussman has direct involvement in some aspect of what Durham calls the joint venture, what I've called the big scheme, this big enterprise by the Clinton campaign to basically smear Donald Trump with a political attack that he was in cahoots with Putin, to generate information that looked like it supported that inference, to peddle it to the media, get the FBI interested in it so that the FBI would agree to investigate it, and then use the fact that the FBI was investigating it to tell the public that it must be pretty serious, otherwise the FBI wouldn't be investigating. So that's the essence of the scheme. And it's a broad scheme in time and place, but the crime that's charged is narrow. It's that Sussman had this meeting on September 19th, 2016, which was set up by a text that he sent to the FBI the night before, wherein he said that he was not representing any client. He just wanted to help the Bureau, as if, as a former Justice Department national security official, he just wanted to help the FBI protect the country from what seemed to him to be a really alarming threat, and that this had nothing to do with clients or politics. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it had precisely to do with clients and politics. So the balance for Judge Cooper is how much of that scheme to let in order to allow Durham what he's entitled to prove, which is that Sussman had a motive to lie to the FBI, and that some of this behavior that he was engaged in is intrinsic to the pattern of conduct in which he goes in and lies to the FBI. So what Cooper seems to be doing, Rich, is basically saying, in connection with this scheme, if Sussman did something personally, like if he was personally involved, the judge is inclined to let it in, which is bad for Sussman because it means that, you know, his everything from his meetings with people at his law firm and Fusion GPS and maybe even Christopher Steele, where all this information was sculpted before it was presented to the FBI, that's all going to come in. And he's going to allow them to prove a lot of records that show that he was billing the Clinton campaign, that he had a lawyer-client relationship with the Clinton campaign. He may even let him call a Clinton campaign witness to come in, who will just assert the attorney-client privilege in refusing to answer questions, which will help Durham prove that there was an attorney-client relationship. So it looks like the judge is disposed to let him do all that. What he's not letting him do is basically turn it into the Hillary Clinton fraud trial. So he's not letting them put in those tweets that we talked about last week, because what he's saying is those tweets happened 6 weeks after Sussman met with the FBI, and there's no evidence that Sussman had anything to do with getting Clinton to tweet them. You can see why they're relevant, but he just thinks they're too attenuated. And his point is that the charge here is the false statement, not the big scam. He's not letting him prove that the information that these internet records that Sussman brought to the FBI were inaccurate. And remember, we talked about the FBI decided that there wasn't enough there to justify a full investigation. The CIA went further and decided the whole thing is bogus and spoofed and fraudulent. The judge is not letting Durham get into whether the records are inaccurate. But the price tag on that for Sussman is that he can't contest that they're accurate. So one of the lines of defense here at the beginning that seemed obvious was, maybe the defense would come in and say Donald Trump really was in cahoots with Putin, and that's why we went there. And therefore, Durham was ready to show that the records are just nonsense and inaccurate and have big problems with them. The defense has agreed that they're not going to try to suggest that the records are accurate. So even though Durham doesn't get to prove the inaccuracies, he may get to do a little of that. It cabins what the defense can say about that. So it hurts Sussman in that way. So I think so far the judge is calling it down the middle. We'll have to see how the trial plays out. The one other thing I would say, Rich, in reaction to the way that you teed this up, because I think this is important. Yes, a false statement is much more a minor crime than, for example, a big conspiracy to defraud the United States would be. And that's part of the reason that the judge is cutting him back. But I do want to stress to people, you know, in these prior special counsel investigations like Mueller's investigation, we always talked about process crimes. Remember, we went through all the, you know, Roger Stone and General Flynn and all. And what we said again and again was these cases where they just charge lying to the FBI, it's like there's no crime and it's just the investigation that generates the crime. I want to point out to people the distinction. That's not what happened here. These are not process crimes. This is not a situation where there was a special counsel investigation and they subpoenaed Sussman and then he came in and lied to the FBI. This is a situation where there was an active fraud and the fraud is on the government and the FBI is basically the agency that's being defrauded and Sussman goes in to hook them in. So it wasn't like an investigation caused him to commit this crime. To the contrary, he was trying to cause the investigation fraudulently. So this is not what I would call a process crime, even though it's a similar scenario to what we've described as process crimes.
So do you think we'll hear from Christopher Steele in this trial?
No, but there's a chance. And there's two interesting aspects of that, Rich. One is, will he testify? And the other is how much of evidence about Steele will come in. On the will he testify front, the best we could say at this point is that he is on the government's witness list, but that Durham has said that he does not expect to call him as a witness because he's in England and he does not expect to be able to get him to the trial to testify. But that doesn't mean he won't. It means it's unlikely. On the second question, this is going to be problematic, I think, for Sussman, because Sussman did meet with Steele, after which Steele puts the Alpha Bank stuff in the dossier, which the FBI ultimately brings to the FISA court to get warrants. So there may be Steele evidence that comes in, and the Sussman defense, you can tell that they are worried about this because they're fighting it so hard. What they're basically telling the judge is, look, the mere mention of Steele is so explosive that it would be too prejudicial to let this in. And so far, Cooper's reaction seems to be, well, you know, maybe you should have thought of that before you dealt with him. Mm-hmm. But it looks like he's going to let it in.
And how about Rodney Jaffe?
Unlikely to testify. The defense wants to call him, they say. Durham has said that he's still the subject of an ongoing investigation, and therefore he would not immunize him. In his rulings last week on the pretrial motions, Judge Cooper said that there was no evidence of any bad faith on the government's part, that they're not posing as potentially calling him as a witness in order to keep him off the stand from giving, you know, helpful testimony to Sussman. But there's one thing, Rich, that I think is intriguing that I would point out about this. And I mentioned that we were having an offline conversation this morning with some of our NR guys who are going to be doing work on the trial. And I mentioned that if I were a prosecutor handling this case, let's say I wanted to charge the big scheme, but I was worried that the statute of limitations may have run on it. You know, the statute of limitations in federal law is 5 years. This scheme, as Durham has described it, pretty much was over in early 2017. So you would think time's not only a waste, and we may be beyond the statute of limitations. But if I were a prosecutor and I really wanted to bring that case and I thought I had it, what I would have done by now is indicted under seal. And the reason you'd put it under seal is if Durham, in say the last month or so, had indicted anyone in the Clinton campaign, Sussman, Jaffe, and anybody else in connection with this, if he had done that and then publicized the indictment, what everybody would have said, and the left would have come down like a ton of bricks on this, everybody would have said that he was poisoning the jury pool with respect to Sussman. So I'm not saying that Durham has necessarily done this, but it's possible that Durham has indicted people and that we're not going to find out about it until after this trial is over. It's also possible that he's going to wind up and there's not going to be any more charges. But he's sure talking a lot about, you know, the possibility of more prosecution.
And we'll definitely hear from Jim Baker, correct? And exactly, you know, how he sounds on this will be important determining how the trial goes.
Yeah. Now, it won't be as important, Rich, as it seemed at the beginning. At the beginning, when it looked like the only evidence that Durham mm-hmm. had was the meeting, where it's just one-on-one and it's Sussman and Baker, it seemed like Baker's recollection would be very important. And, you know, Baker has given, I think he's testified 4 or 5 times about this between congressional committees and IG investigations and the like. I don't know if Durham's put him in the grand jury or not. But you worry that his testimony was a little bit inconsistent and all over the map about what his understanding was about what Sussman was up to. But I think all that kind of goes out the window now that we have the text. You know, we have a clear text that is unmistakably a statement by Sussman to the FBI that basically says, I am not representing any client. I'm just coming to you because I want to help the Bureau. I mean, he said that in black and white. So I think now Baker's testimony along those lines is much less important. And the odd fallout of that is, you know, Durham could end up finding that he has a much more cooperative Baker than he might otherwise have had, because the case doesn't really rise or fall on Baker anymore. It's, you know, you have the text.
And obviously a DC jury, how much does that matter? We expect jurors to, you know, obviously very liberal jury pool, but would they look at a case like this through politicized lens the way hyper engaged people would?
I think you really have to worry about that. I mean, in DC, DC is a very political city. I mean, I know that, like, we always talk about how, you know, we're unusually engaged in politics compared to the average people. And I think that's true. But DC is more engaged in politics than the average city. It, like, oozes politics. You know, when you get out of at Union Station and hop in a cab, they have NPR playing. It's like the soundtrack of Washington. So they're very hostile to Republicans. They're very hostile to Trump. You know, look, it's the only when Richard Nixon won his landslide victory, he won every state except Massachusetts, and he lost the District of Columbia. Right? I think Reagan lost even in Reagan's landslide. I believe he lost the District of Columbia. They don't like Republicans, and they especially don't like Trump. So this is not a home game for Durham by any stretch of the imagination. Hopefully, it's going to be a very exacting jury selection process, and the judge will give them leeway to boot people off the jury if they have real grounds to suspect that they're, you know, going to look at this through a political lens. But I don't envy them. It would not be fun to pick a jury for this case.
And then finally, just let's hit briefly, obviously ongoing thing last 6 months or so, whatever it's been, is this really dumb and disturbing Merrick Garland letter about the threats at school boards. So we're just talking about how the feds are falling down in their duty in protecting Supreme Court justices against intimidation. So this seemed to be an affirmative way to actually use federal law enforcement to intimidate people. But it's your view that the FBI has done a pretty good job staying in appropriate lane and not letting itself get used for this purpose?
Yeah, I think so, Rich. You know, there's been a kind of a resuscitation of this story this week, because a couple of top Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan and Mike Johnson, have written a letter to Garland, once again questioning whether he gave truthful testimony when he said that the FBI would not label parents as domestic terrorists, and that there was no reason to believe that they had used Patriot Act and other counterterrorism measures to investigate America's parents. And Jordan's been pushing back on this. And his theory in pushing back on it is that we now know that the FBI opened a category of cases on what's known as a threat tag, which is just a label. You know, people should understand that Jordan is talking about this like it's an investigation itself, or that it invokes a bunch of, counterterrorism authorities. It doesn't. It's just an administrative label under which it's like a file folder where they put all the investigations that they did along these lines in response to what Garland did. Now, because the threat tag, which they call, EDU officials, that was EDU officials, that's the tag that they use for all these cases. And what that means is wherever in the 50 states, if you're an FBI agent, if you're investigating something because of this Garland directive that has to do with potential violence against school officials, you tag it EDU officials. And what that allows is the bean counters and analysts in Washington can look at all these cases together and see if there are patterns of behavior and if they need more resources and that sort of thing. The Bureau has a million of these. Everything they do has some kind of a tag on it. So it's not unusual that they would do that. But what Jordan and Johnson have deduced, and this is a very extravagant deduction, which there's no support for, at least in the record as we know it, is that because one of the officials who came up with this threat tag was the head of the counterintelligence division, that this means all of these cases are being carried as domestic terrorism cases. And from that, he leaps to the conclusion that the FBI must be using the Patriot Act or FISA or, you know, some of its terrorism authorities to investigate the parents. So that's the theory that he lays out. But then he shows that the brave whistleblowers, he says, that he's been dealing with, give him these three instances, and it's basically nothing. I mean, they have one case where a school board said, a parent said, we're coming for you. And what it turned out, the FBI did go out and interview that mother, and it turned out that, she said, yeah, they're terrible. We're going to try to get them replaced.
Right.
We're trying to. So the FBI got that and immediately closed the case. And there's reason to think that when the school board people reported this, they said, the person was right wing and she may even own a gun and, all the usual stuff. But the Bureau went out, they talked to this woman, they were satisfied there was nothing there, and they closed the case immediately. The other two cases that Jordan and Johnson talk about, there's no indication the FBI did anything. In one case, they went out and interviewed the complainant rather than the person that was being complained about. And the complainant admitted, well, I don't really actually have any, evidence that the person did anything criminally wrong. And then in another case, they say the Democratic officials wanted Republican legislators to be investigated because they were protesting vaccine mandates, and that could be very volatile and cause violence. And there's even Jordan doesn't indicate that the FBI did anything except get a complaint. So what I think people need to understand is even if there was no threat tag here, even if there was no such thing as EDU officials, the FBI gets tips and complaints all the time. They would get tips and complaints anyway. And the issue is, what did they do with them? And what Jordan and Johnson say at the end of their letter, after they've exaggerated all this stuff, they say, fortunately and appropriately, the FBI looked at this stuff and saw that it was complete BS and instantly closed it. And the other thing I want people to understand is, there are investigations and there are investigations. When the FBI gets a tip or a complaint, some of the stuff that comes in is crazy. Some of it is not so crazy. Some of it is very alarming. It's all different, it's very human. It's all different categories of how seriously you can take things. What they ordinarily do, if they don't dismiss something out of hand completely, is they go out and kick the tires a little bit. They call it a preliminary investigation. It's not a fully predicated, full-blown investigation. What they do is they check a few things. They go out and they say, is there really something here worth investigating? And what they'll often find is either there's no federal jurisdiction, or even if there is federal jurisdiction, it doesn't look like a crime happened, or even if a crime did happen, it doesn't come up to our standards for something serious enough to merit federal prosecution. That's done all the time, and it doesn't become a full-blown investigation. So Jordan and Johnson say again and again in their letter, the FBI opened an investigation on this and an open investigation. You want the FBI to go out and do a little checking when they hear something that's disturbing. Mm-hmm. And we all know, Rich, if they got something that sounded bizarro and they didn't go out and check it, and then something really terrible happened, right, they'd have a scandal in the other direction. I have to tell you, if the day before the World Trade Center got bombed, February 25th, 1993, if someone had called my office and said, we're going to blow up the World Trade Center tomorrow, my reaction would have been, well, let me know how that works out for you. Mm-hmm. Right. Because there was no reason at that point to suspect that kind of stuff was going on. So they have to make judgments and vet information. But the fact that they have done something that, you know, politically is being referred to as an investigation doesn't mean it's the 4-year Durham investigation. You know, it may just mean that they went out and talked to a complainant and found out that it was nonsense. Or they went out and talked to a mom and found and said, no, when I said I'm going to get them, I mean, we're trying to get them voted out, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't think the FBI should be involved in stuff that's not federal, but you don't want them to just sit on their hands. You want them to do a little, you know, checking around.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks everyone for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.